Hey, good morning to everybody. It's just about 11:15. We'll be starting in about 2 minutes. Today we'll be taking up the Haftorah of Tzav. In Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 21. Chapter 7, verse 21. And we'll do a little read through it. It goes through to the end of chapter 8, verse 3, and then jumps to chapter 9. For two more verses, which are 9:22 and 23. We'll have to understand why it jumps there to conclude and what the messages are. It's a short Haftorah, but there's a number of very salient points here regarding sacrifice and idolatry. Again, we'll just start in about a minute. Verses are on screen there. It's Jeremiah 7:21. Doug, good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. All right. Okay, are we waiting for anybody to join us?
I think we were expecting one more, but...
Okay, so let's wait until they come on.
Okay.
And what we'll take up today is the Haftorah, the portion that we read yesterday, which is in Jeremiah 7:21 through 8:3, and there's also two more verses after that.
Okay, I'm gonna grab a Tanakh if you can hang on.
Okay, sure. Okay, we'll try to adjust that sound. Time, so the phone is not so close to the mic. And if you have the text with you, it'll be very helpful. Again, it's Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 21. It's yesterday's Haftorah portion. And interesting. It's really a good lesson in terms of how to go through an area of the prophets. So while we're waiting for the next moment for people to join, take a look. Again, 7:21 through 8:3. And then verses 9, 22, and 23. Let's read it in the meantime, but start reading in English. And we'll get the facts as to what the actual Haftarah is addressing. And keep in mind that we just started Leviticus last week, and that is dealing with sacrifice, now that the temple was constructed. So all the order of sacrifices is discussed last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha. But there are flaws with the nature of worship. It becomes a double-edged sword. So we'll start reading. I'll read it in English. Okay, so it starts again, 7:21 in Jeremiah. Thus says God, the Master of Legions, God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your peace offerings, and eat their meat. For I did not speak with your forefathers, nor did I command them on the day I took them out of the land of Egypt, concerning burnt or peace offerings. Meaning God is first saying a sarcastic rebuke. Go ahead, add on all your carbon, add to your sacrifices. I never asked you to do this. And continues in 23, rather, it was only this thing that I commanded them, meaning what did I command your forefathers? Saying that you should listen to my voice, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. And you will go on the entire way that I command you, so that it will be well for you. And then God says afterwards, in 24, but they did not listen, and they did not incline the ear, but followed their own counsels and the visions of their evil hearts. They went backwards and not forwards. From the day your forefathers left the land of Egypt until this day, I sent you all my servants, the prophets, daily, rising early and sending forth. But they, meaning the forefathers of the Jews, they would not listen to me, God says, and they would not incline their ear. They stiffened their neck and became worse than the forefathers. You will tell them all these things, but they will not listen to you. You will call out to them, but they will not answer you. So this is what God is saying that he said to the prophets. This is the nation that would not listen to the voice of God. So now God is giving a rebuke to this current nation. And he says, this is a nation that would not listen to the voice of God, its God, and they would not accept rebuke. Faith is lost, it is detached from the speech. So now he uses a euphemism in terms of what you should mourn. He says, tear out your hair and throw it away. Proclaim lament from the hilltops, for God has rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. For the children of Judah have done what is evil in my eyes, the word of God. They have placed their abominations in the temple upon which my name is proclaimed, and they contaminated it. And they built high places of Tophes that are in the valley of the son of Chinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in fire, which I, God, had not commanded, and had not entered my mind. Therefore, behold, days are coming, the word of God, when it will no longer be called Tophes or the valley of the son of Chinnom, but the valley of killing. So God is saying that this place that they worship idolatry will eventually be changed to the name called the Valley of Killing. For they will bury in Tophes, meaning in that place, they will bury until there is no more room. The corpses of the Jews of this people will become food for the birds of the heavens and the animals of the earth, and none will make them afraid. I will eliminate from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem, the sound of joy and the sound of gladness, the sound of groom and the sound of bride, for the land will become ruin. At that time, the word of God, they will remove the bones of the kings of Judah, the bones of its leaders, the bones of the priests, the bones of the prophets, and the bones of Jerusalem's inhabitants from their graves. And they will spread them out under the sun and the moon, and all the heavenly legions, meaning all the heavenly spheres which they loved and which they worshipped, and which they followed and which they sought out, to which they prostrated themselves. They will not be gathered together or buried, meaning the bones will stay out there forever. They will be like dung upon the face of the earth, yet death will be preferable to life for the surviving remnant of this evil family, in all the places of the survivors where I will have driven them. So God is saying, the word of God, master of religions. So God is saying that these people, these Jews, the leaders, the priests, the prophets, were idolatrous, and they worshipped the sun and the moon. So the response is that God says the bones of these people, these leaders, the prophets, the priests, all these Jews, the inhabitants, will be laid out on the earth's surface in front of the sun and the moon. Okay. All right. And then it skips to 9, 22, and 23. So just go further for a moment. And it reads as this. This says God, let not the wise man glorify himself with his wisdom, and let not the strong man glorify himself with his strength. Let not the rich man glorify himself with his wealth. For only with this may one glorify himself, contemplating and knowing me, for I am Hashem who does kindness, justice, and righteousness in the land, for in these is my desire, the word of God. That's the end of the Haftarah. Okay, so take a look again from the beginning. And just to review, it's always good to go through it at least twice. And again, that's 7:21 through 8:3. Take a moment. Okay. So it's a rebuke. The first thing God says is what? He says that, sort of like a sarcastic statement, he says, go ahead, keep on increasing your sacrifices, because this is not what I asked of you. I had asked that you follow me. So what's the first rebuke?
That they're doing things by rote, but not true underlying intent.
I don't see rote necessarily as being what God is isolating.
Or not rote, but they're going ahead and doing the stuff and the sacrifices, but without understanding the real reason why God intended for them to do them.
So why are they doing it? God says here that He says, go ahead, add all your keep on adding sacrifices. I never asked of this from your forefathers. All right?
Well, if the verse doesn't tell us, then I guess I could guess at two possible reasons. One is to impress each other, or the other is the religious emotion.
Okay, well, let's look at the text. Let's take a look and see if we can get it from the text, because that's really the rule, right? There's just enough information to raise the questions, and that very information is going to give us the answers. So, he says, rather, in 7:23, rather, and by the way, how's it sound? Does it okay sound?
Yeah, the sound is okay.
Okay. He says, rather, it was only this thing that I commanded, saying, listen to my voice. But what's God's rebuke after that? He says, if you listen to my voice, and that I will be your God, then you will be my people. And you will go in the entire way that I command you, and it will be well for you. So that is what is God saying the preferred method for you to live is. But God rebukes through the prophet Jeremiah and says, "But and this is a 7:24 now, but they did not listen, and they did not incline the ear, but followed their own counsels and the visions of their evil heart. They went backwards and not forwards." Okay. And again he says, he seems to repeat something, from the day your forefathers left the land of Egypt until this day, I sent you all my servants, the prophets, rising daily and speaking to you and sending forth messages to you, but you did not listen. And you see earlier he says in 22, for I did not speak with your forefathers, nor did I command them on the day I took them out of the land of Egypt. Well, why is God bringing me in Egypt twice? All right, that's a question, right? It's definitely there for a reason. We know that you know, real estate of Torah is extremely at a premium, and only what's written is essential. Okay, so each verse here is a clue.
So, Rabbi, can you give us sort of time chronological context here? When is this taking place?
I don't have the year. Let me see if I could quickly...
Or just
quickly.
Even... I mean, I'm assuming this is way after Sinai and way after the Torah's been given.
Yeah, let's see. If I have it back here... Yeah, there's usually a map of a time frame. Let's see if we can locate it quickly. looks like it's about 3,300s.
Okay, then I'm confused by a question.
Yep.
Because if God is saying, go ahead and add to your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, because I didn't speak with your forefathers or command them on the day I took them out of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or peace offerings, but I only commanded them, saying, hearken to my voice and so forth. But at Sinai, he did command them regarding burnt offerings and peace offerings, and that's a halakhic commandment that devolves upon them.
Good question.
So it sounds like he's getting after them for following a command that he gave them and saying, well, way back in Egypt I didn't give them this command. Well, that's true, but you did subsequently.
Right, so God did subsequently tell them to offer sacrifices. How, over here, can he say in 7:21 that I never commanded your fathers in sacrifice?
Right.
Okay. But you see,
he never says I didn't command them. He says I didn't command them on the day I took them out of Egypt.
Right. So what is God doing? He's now going back to the cause of their problem. It's true that he gave commands for sacrifice up to this point, because this is much after, this is long after the Torah was given, which includes the commands. But precisely that's why this is the Haftorah of the parsha we just read yesterday of Tzav, because Tzav is talking again, just like Vayikra, all about the sacrifices. But there is a corruption in sacrifices if it's not done for the right reason, and that's what God is trying to hone in on. And he's saying that although I commanded you in sacrifice, but I didn't command you in what you're doing now. Now you have the traces of your forefathers of Egypt. That germ is still in you. That's what he's saying. That's what God references Egypt twice over here. It's true, I did command you, but what you're doing, I didn't command. What did I command you? Rather, it was this thing that I commanded them, saying, listen to my voice. Meaning, when I tell you to do the sacrifices, it's in order that you do it properly. So God is now isolating the sin as being that they're going through the actions, right, of sacrifice, but their understanding of what they're supposed to be doing with sacrifice is completely lost.
Rabbi?
Yes.
When he mentioned Egypt twice and the fact that he said you've gone back to the way before your forefathers, that indicates to me that they've become idolatrous in their thinking, because Egypt was kind of the land of idolatry, and before Abraham, they were worshiping idols.
Exactly, exactly. And that's precisely why later on in this Haftorah, you see that God says, he equates it to what they're doing. You've built high places. Verse 31. Right? For the children of Judah have done what is evil in my eyes, the word of God. They have placed their abominations in the temple, meaning idols. 31, it says, they have built the high places of Tophis in the valley of Chinnom, the sons of Chinnom, and they burned their sons and their daughters in fire, which I had not commanded, nor had it entered my mind. So you see exactly what you're saying, Cal, that he is equating what they're doing with their sacrifice. See, they latched on to the physical activity without having the inner perfection. So that's what God is telling them. Go ahead, add more sacrifices on. This is not what I want. When I told you to do sacrifices, it was that you should accept me as God. But you're doing sacrifices, and now you have this wrong idea of what God is. Because you're also bringing idols into the temple. You're giving in, you're venting to human emotion. And I think there's a very fundamental idea over here. If you look at what it says that in 31 it says that you burnt your sons and daughters in fire, which I had not commanded and had not entered my mind. Now let's understand this for a second. How can this be that people would do this? That they would burn their sons and daughters? And this was, of course, the practice called Molech. And there's a dispute among the rabbis whether they actually burnt them or they just passed them through two pillars of fire that were like, you know, 5-6 feet apart, whatever, and they went in between without burning them at all. But according to the view that they did burn them in fire, what does this tell you about the idolatrous person?
They've lost their rational faculty.
Right, that's number one. Their rational faculty is completely gone. But can you think of something worse than burning your own child. Now, if you had to imagine the most devious, barbaric, evil type of activity, you couldn't think of something worse, should you? I mean...
No, actually, destruction of one's own child would be about the worst horror I could imagine.
Right. Now, where does this come from? Of course, God is saying that you're doing things which had not entered my mind. Okay? He also says, take a look at verse 25, a little bit higher up. He says that you went in the counsel of the freeness of your heart, that is evil. And you went backwards, not forwards.
Rabbi?
Yes.
It seems like in order to do that, you would have no... It seems like they're kind of in a power, like they're the ones that are in control and making decisions. Like they've just completely discounted God, a higher authority, and they've taken over as far as giving life and death. That it's their decision.
Well, they're doing this for the idol. So they're not doing it bereft of being subjugated to an idol, you have to realize.
But they're kind of making the decision of what's right and wrong or what they should do. They're not paying attention to what God told them to do.
Right, true. And this is different, just to answer what Chaim is asking right now on screen. He's asking, is there no conflict with the Akedah when Abraham intended on sacrificing Isaac? Of course there's a big difference because that was expressed to him by prophecy. He knew that was God talking to him. Here, these people are just doing what they feel. But the question is, let's try to understand what brings a person, let's understand the human psyche that brings a person to this level. And since they're actually doing it in the name of a God, so it's not that they now want to take the place of God. They still feel that they are now serving, seeing something greater than themselves. That would not be the case if you were like a Haman who thought he was omnipotent and had people bowing down to him. That would be similar to what you're saying, Cal. But here, it says that they went with the freeness of their heart. It's giving you some hints. The Torah actually has a verse also. Because people, God says in the Torah itself, again, like Rabbi Chaid explained, there's nothing new in prophets. Everything is in the five books of Moses. So when you see a concept here, it's more of it expresses it, it elaborates, but it's still based on all the truths that are contained in the five books in the Torah. So the Torah talks about this as well, that a person will bless himself inside and he goes against the Torah and he says, no, I'm doing what my heart feels right. He feels convinced that anything he feels, do what you feel. You know, that's a notion that our society unfortunately has today. Do what you feel is good. Do what's in your heart. So what happens is that when you go with the emotion, and like Doug, you said, the first step is that the rationale is suspended. Now, what happens when your rationale is suspended? The same thing that happened at the gold calf. They weren't only involved in idolatry, but in eating and drinking and in sex. Because once you let the emotions start going on a path, they have no limit. See, by very definition, emotions are seeking full satisfaction. Now, there are a myriad of emotions. Okay? And to answer what Deanne is asking is, why do they think that passing the children through the fire would bring them blessings? I'll explain to you why I believe this is so. And that is because a person can go on the path of the sexual and he keeps on satisfying that desire and it grows and grows and grows and he just goes and he can get to the point where the nymphomaniac and they just cannot seem to ever get that satisfaction. One satisfaction is followed by a new desire. Same thing with food. People can get onto a frenzy. They have bulimia, anorexia. You also have this in all the emotions. I mean, King Solomon said it, that a person who loves money isn't satisfied by money. That's just another expression of this very same idea. That once you start caving in and satisfying emotions, emotion by definition doesn't have a limit. Okay, it's an important thing to understand. So now, what were they doing here? The emotion here was idolatrous. And now, in terms of being in a state of subjugated to an idol, when you start, if you're unguided, if you are completely unguided in your approach, so now, what's the emotion that you're trying to satisfy? Subjugation. So now, I believe what happens is that the emotion of a person will just try to seek out the greatest way to express subjugation. And what's the greatest type of subjugation? What is the greatest sacrifice I can give?
My kid.
Right, your child. I believe this is where it eventuates, and that's the ridicule. I believe that if you follow that trend and that type of a feeling of, I got to do something for this God, I start imagining how great this God is, and whatever I feel, but I'm getting into the state of mind where I must service this God, and I just try to satisfy. How selfless can I be? This is Christianity. Christianity is where the person who slaps you on one cheek, you give him the other. The very same emotion. I can, why? Because that's now another emotion which you take to the extreme. That's called forgiveness. If you take forgiveness to the extreme, that means even if somebody kills your son, I'll adopt that person into my house and show him complete mercy. That has happened in reality. I know a case of that, where somebody killed somebody else's son, and the parents of the that were bereaved, they took in the murderer. And this is a complete unguided emotion of forgiveness. So if you take any emotion and you just follow it without rationale, this is where it ends up. A completely unintelligible expression, because we're looking at this intelligently. But if you want to appreciate how the emotions work, if they are not guided, so then they just go down a path to the utmost extreme, because that's what an emotion is. It is looking for satisfaction without any yield whatsoever. You see?
Yes, I was just thinking of the Jim Jones tragedy and the Waco tragedy.
Yeah, what happened in those cases?
Well, the Jim Jones thing was over where he had a whole bunch of followers, and they went to the ultimate point of he decided they should all commit suicide by drinking poison Kool-Aid. And I think it was hundreds died.
Yeah, they all, their selflessness, they gave into the emotion of selflessness, you see? Any emotion can be taken to the extreme, and it will be.
So, I'm curious, and I don't know if there's an answer, and if this is too far a stream, we can pick it up another time. But if you've got various emotions like the appetitive instinct for food, the instinct for sex, some other things, what causes one of those emotions to go way off kilter and go unbridled versus another one? For example, some people get caught up in the sexual thing and just go down that road until I don't know what the end point is. Other people get caught up maybe in one around food, but not everybody gets caught up around every one.
Well, it could be a lot of factors why this person will pick food, that person will pick sex. It could be what they're used to. That, I feel, will have a lot to do with it. It could be societal, what the swing is in society right now, what my friends are doing. Again, there's a number of emotions, and the stronger ones could be the ones that they're most used to, or ones that they might be curious about, that might be on their mind at that time in their life.
Okay.
Let me just address, Chaim is saying, when cults adopt innocence to brainwash them to become bank robbers, is adoption always a kindness? No, that's complete greed in that case, Chaim. I disagree with Kuzari. When they adopt innocent people just for their own, selfish, greedy ends, so of course that's not a kindness. Kindness has to be where it's judged. And you'll see, while we're on the topic, if you just turn to the last two verses, why does the Haftorah end with the verse? It skips
And it goes 9:22-23. Reads as this. This says God. Thus says God, let not the wise man glorify himself in his wisdom. And the Radak says, what does it mean a wise man shouldn't glorify himself in wisdom? I mean, isn't Judaism all about wisdom? No, it's talking here where the person uses intelligence, but it's not to lead him to God, meaning he has no concept of God. So there, even using intelligence is going to be corruption. You see that? If a person just uses intelligence for a wrong objective, so even intelligence can be used wrong. So God says, let the wise man, who uses intelligence, which is not for me, let him not glorify in his wisdom, let not the strong man glorify himself in his strength, and let not the rich man glorify himself in his wealth. For only with this may one glorify himself. With what? With contemplating and knowing me. For I am God who does kindness, justice, and righteousness in the land. So at the very end of the Guide to the Perplexed, Maimonides takes up this verse, and he expresses how it's insufficient to the person who just has the right ideas of God. It doesn't just end with that a person should glorify in knowing me. Right? Kuzuri, okay, I see your point on screen. Thanks, I stand corrected. All right, so God does not end by saying that you should glorify in knowing me. No, he adds on the words, for I am God who does kindness, justice, and righteousness in the land. Meaning if a person's knowledge doesn't follow through an action, then there is a rift in that individual and he's not perfected. Because the way a human being is designed is that true conviction must follow through an action. If a person says, I love kindness, but he doesn't ever perform it, then he truly cannot be making a statement that's accurate. Because one who really loves something performs. And that's what God is saying. That you must contemplate and know me, for I am God who does kindness, justice, and righteousness in the land. Okay? So, he's saying that this is what we must do also. And there's an interesting redoc on that verse. Very interesting. It's something similar to what a friend of mine said recently. He says that who is a righteous person? Let me see where he says this. For the righteous person judges the case of the poor and the ones who have nothing, the evyon, the needy. He judges the case. Interesting. He doesn't just openly give, but even when it comes to mercy, he's not going to the opposite extreme where you help anybody, like a Mother Teresa, that would put a bandage on an Arafat. See, that would be misguided pity and mercy. You don't do that. Everything, every area is governed by intelligence. That's why it says here that who is a righteous person? He judges the case of the poor and the needy. Because even a poor person could come before the judge and be a liar. So you don't just, carte blanche, give whatever the poor person needs just because they're poor. You have to judge him. His intelligence is guided. You never allow even the pity emotion to overtake you. And then he says after that, then the person like that will have the good. And he says, Az Tovlo, Halohu Hadas, and he's one that knows me. Why? Because he says as follows, this is the Radak. He says, because the actions of justice and charity, that is knowledge of God. Again, because the actions of justice and charity is knowledge of God. Not just the abstract thinking. No, the actions. When you act out, that's when you have true knowledge of God. That's when the knowledge becomes part of your soul, when you act upon it. Okay, that's a very important lesson. And that's how the Haftorah ends, is when you're acting on, you're using your intelligence in those cases, even in the other side, even when you're doing what is right. Because it started out by saying, go ahead, God's saying sarcastically, add your sacrifices, go ahead. But he says, did I ever ask for this? It's not the sacrifice per se. You think that this is something which is written factually in the Torah, so therefore any type of sacrifice is a good thing? No, you can take anything and corrupt it. And he ends with that point, too, that you have to do righteousness in the land, and the Radak just said, you judge the case of the poor person and the needy person. And real knowledge of God is when you are acting out justice and charity. Okay? So that means what God really wants is, like he says in the beginning, you have to follow me. Don't just do the actions. No, there has to be, listen to my voice, meaning use intelligence, understanding, right? Doug, that's to your point right at the beginning. Okay, but he says, no, that they were stiff-necked. And that's what happens. See, this is a symptom of somebody who's living a religious life that is religious fervor and not religious, you know, an intelligent religious life. Because the person who's living in a religious fervor, you rebuke them. God says that he sent the prophets. Right, he says in verse 25, 7:25, I sent you my servants, the prophets, daily, rising early and sending forth. But they would not listen to me, and they would not incline the ear. They stiffened their neck. What does he say? They stiffened their neck and they became worse than the forefathers? It means when a person is living the religious life and he's bringing those sacrifices, but he's doing it out of an emotion, so then he can't hear intelligence. So if you ever have a conversation with somebody and the immediate response is a rejection, then you know that they're just functioning emotionally and they're not really trying to listen to intelligence. If they were, they would listen to what you said and they would respond accordingly. Well, it makes sense. And you'll find that in the world. The people who are religious fanatics, they immediately respond too fast and they respond with a defensiveness. That's what God is describing here. They stiffen their neck and they became worse than their forefathers. Okay, so a number of lessons so far. And they went to the extreme of sacrificing their own child. And that's what happens when you give into the emotion. Now, what does God do? He says that if you look at the beginning of chapter 8, so they started worshiping all these gods, and the sun, the moon. So God says the response is going to be that at that time, right? 8:1 in Jeremiah, at that time the word of God, they will remove the bones of the kings of Judah, the bones of its leaders, the bones of its priests, the bones of the prophets, meaning that the greatest of Jews were idolaters back then, and the bones of Jerusalem's inhabitants from their graves, and spread them out under the sun and the moon and all the heavenly legion. Meaning, go ahead, take the bones of these people that were worshiping the sun and moon, put them on the ground. Why does God say that this is the proper response? It's very odd, isn't it? We never heard of a case like this.
Rabbi, it almost seems like it's some kind of a public demonstration for others to see that this is the ultimate end when you go down this road.
Okay, but what does he say? Put it in front of the sun and all the heavenly legions. The sun and the moon and the heavenly legions, which they loved, and which they worshipped, and which they followed, and which they sought out, and to which they prostrated themselves. They will not be gathered, meaning the bones will not be gathered, nor buried. They will be like dung upon the face of the earth, yet death will be preferable to life for the surviving remnant of this evil family. In all the places of the survivors where I have driven them. So he says two things. That the ones who died, who followed these gods, right, their bones will be taken out of the grave and spread across the ground, right, in the light of the sun, the moon. And in terms of their surviving remnants of those people, they'll be put away in exile.
So, is it a demonstration such that, okay, you guys worshipped all these things that are not gods, so now I'm going to lay your bones out in front of them, and the world can see whether they will do anything to resurrect you or restore you or to save you.
Perfect. Please. Perfect. Exactly. Exactly. You got it. That's the exact lesson. You worship them? Let's see if they can save you. Right? Isn't that exactly what Elijah did at Mount Carmel when he brought up the worshippers of Baal? who they accepted God and they accepted this idol. So he says, call out, maybe he's sleeping. Yell louder, maybe he's sleeping. Let's see if he answers. And then when you're done, I'll call out to God and see if he answers. Right, shows a stark contrast. These are the ones you worshipped here. Put the bones out. Let's see if they do anything. You guys are dead. You're just a pile of bones. Exactly. Very well. Very good, Doug.
So then the second part.
Right.
Is he saying, if I think about those, the remaining alive people that are doing that, could he be saying, when it says death will be preferable to life, like, you're going to have pain and suffering and a lot of discomfort in life because of the lifestyle you've chosen, and in death, there's going to be nothing. So, you know, death will be preferable to you than life.
Right.
So no death for you is just, you know, your bones are scattered and that's it.
Right. I mean, he's showing that both groups of these idolaters, the ones that are dead and the ones that are alive, have evil become to them, and there's no good in the life that they imagined. The ones who worship the sun and the moon, look, their bones are out there, they're dead. That's it. This is all there is to them. And those of you who are alive, who follow in this way, look what you have. You're in exile. You're wishing that you were dead. Your life is so rotten. At the same time, that is a promise of God, which is coming true, and it validates God's word. So when there is that promise of God that you will have this type of an end, you'll be in exile, and it takes place, who is validated now? And who is invalidated? In one action, the words of the idolatrous people are invalidated, because look, they have a terrible life when they worship the sun and moon. And at the same time, since God forecasted their exile, and now they are in exile, God's validated. You see how it works?
Yes.
So he talks about the corruption emotionally and how it leads and how it's akin to idolatry. So first starts talking about the sacrifices. And then it brings up that they set up idols in the temple and they burnt their children. So it's telling you that their sacrifices are akin to idolatry, like you said, Cal, at the beginning. Not only that, but when you follow the emotional life, so then it goes to the most horrific extremes. Because emotion only knows satisfaction. And whichever emotion you pick, that's where it will go. If it's hunger, if it's food that you're after, so then you're going to become a glutton. If it's sex, then you become sick with that type of a disease. If it's subservience, if that's the emotion that you're giving into by being idolatrous, so then you'll go to the extreme of wanting to show how subservient you are. Look what I'm doing for you, my great stone god. I'm killing my child. Look how, right? So that's how far we'll go. If it's selflessness, I'll take in the murderer of my own son into my house and forgive him. Meaning, if forgiveness is the emotion that now I'm getting into, that's where my emotions lead, and I just get absorbed into forgiveness, like Christianity preaches. So then you have a foolish activity. You harbor somebody who's a killer in your house, they'll end up killing you. Just because you want to demonstrate to your own mind, oh, look into my own emotions, look how forgiving I am. I'll even take in, look at that, what a great feeling that gives me right now. And it's really ego, because in that case, you're trying to look how proud you are that I can go this far. I can go so far and deny my own real sense of justice. I could take the murder of my own child into my house. I mean, there may be other psychological things at play there, where they miss the child so much, and that combines with the emotion of pity that they view the murderer as their own son. I mean, you could have a twist. I mean, you have the Patty Hearst case where somebody who kidnaps you, you start becoming allegiant to their cause. The Stockholm Syndrome. So you see that there's much to understand about the human emotion, but you see here how the prophet knew all about it. This is not new discoveries in the 21st century here. It's all right here. Okay. And you see that God's response is to educate them on the fallacy. Finally, put the bones out there in front of the sun. Let's see if it really does anything. And there were Elijah saying, call out to the Baal. See if he answers you. But the Radak says at the end, no, the real life is when even, don't go to the opposite extreme now and don't fall prey to that, where now you're going to just be very charitable and do anything that the poor man asks you. Don't do that either. Judge the case. The intelligence has to be guiding both sides, whether it's removing you from the negative or doing the positive. The intelligence must be there. That's why it says you have to judge the case of the poor. Right? The Torah also says it. Don't recognize faces in judgment. Meaning, don't favor a poor man in the case just because he is now one litigant and the other litigant is a billionaire. Don't favor the poor man because you feel bad for him and he needs money. That's not justice. Justice is to listen to the case of both people. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I was wondering about the beggar on the street. You know, sometimes you wonder when you see them either smoking cigarettes or, you know, you kind of wonder, are they going to use this money for cigarettes or booze or drugs? And, you know, now you're saying judge the poor man. How do we do that, or how do we know?
Well, the question is not to judge whether he is a poor man. The question I'm saying is that when you judge the case, when you have a court case and he comes before you, that's what the Radak is saying. You're done din ani. You judge the case. That means there's some sort of a case in front of you. But when you have a poor person on the street, you're not allowed to turn aside anybody. Doesn't matter whether Jewish, not Jewish. There's a law. You can't turn aside somebody. So you give him something. Rabbi Chayit actually said once that if a person is at the point where he will go over to you and ask you for money, so then he is a poor person. He does need it. What he uses it on is his decision, but you're doing it as an act of kindness and engendering that. And the tendency is there all the time, you know. One person asks you, and down the block another person's there, and down the block another person's there. So there's that feeling itself is another type of feeling. When you just see one person on the street, all right, I'm doing a good deed, it feels good, there's a certain ego involved. Really, it should be done out of you have to not just give the person, but the law is that you're supposed to commiserate with the person. But, I mean, if you have knowledge that the person is really lying, so then you have to use that as well. That would be considered like, you know, judging the case. But there is a limit also as to what you're supposed to give, too. And if a person is going around to many, many people, you know, the obligation is not upon you to give them everything they need. You can give them a quarter. You fulfilled your obligation. You see the number of lessons that we get just from a small little section over here about Jeremiah. And you see that, again, Egypt is mentioned twice. To your point, Doug, that they already had the command of sacrifice. How could God say that I ever ask you for sacrifice? Yeah, God means I didn't ask you for this type of sacrifice when you're doing it for the wrong reason. And you think that just by, you know, in another place, God rebukes the Jews through the prophet and says, what are you trampling in my courtyard for? I mean, it's like a way of saying, you know, you're coming into the temple, but it's really just trampling. You're not there for the right reasons. So what you're really just doing is just you're making a trampling sound. You're you know, ruining the grass. And Chaim, you're asking, is there any place where we're supposed to follow an instruction blindly? Only the Jews accepted. See, if you take a look, last week we put out, I think it was March 14th, if you take a look at the Jewish Times, So we put out an article, Na'ase V'Nishma. So Na'ase V'Nishma means we will do and we will follow. So the Jews heard a certain amount of the Torah before they accepted the obligation to keep it, which makes sense. So when they heard that certain amount of Torah from Moses, so they saw the clarity, the reasoning behind it, it was pleasant to them, and they said, this system we will accept. And although they didn't hear the entire Torah yet, just a portion of it, they said, and also, since we see the system is based on fundamentals that are true, we know that anything else that this God commands us will be sensible. And we accept upon ourselves even that which we have not heard yet. But it wasn't blindly, all right? It was based on hearing a good portion of, you know, good representation of what the Torah fundamentals are. They accepted it based on that, so that was Na'ase. They now did something of an act. That was an act of using rationality, because they listened, it made sense, they followed it. But then they also realized that they don't have complete knowledge of God. They can't know to the nth degree every single perfection that are involved in the Torah. So they made a next statement which was equally valuable before God. And they said, we will do, meaning not only will we do and perform what we already heard, it makes sense, but even that which we have not heard yet, we will follow because we recognize the limits of human intelligence. And that was really the dual approach necessary. That's why it says that they were euphemistically rewarded with crowns. Two crowns, because they made two statements that really represented the right approach for a human being. You use intelligence, but then you recognize that your intelligence is limited. So you admit your human limitation. At the same time, you do use your intelligence as far as you can. Okay, any other questions?
I think we're good here.
Good there, Ken.
Very interesting idea, Rabbi. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. My pleasure. And again, just to repeat, this is the Haftorah for yesterday's Parsha Tzav, because we're dealing with sacrifice. But sacrifice has to be approached rationally. It's not just that I bring an animal and I kill it and now I'm absolved or I've done something good. No, a person has to be bringing it properly. A person can't bring a sacrifice for idolatrous emotion. And the second mention of Egypt Chaim, since you're asking, is the first one is 722. Okay, and the second one is 725. Okay, and Kuzari, you're asking, since you're mentioning the point, it's an important question. You're asking just why would God tell us to bring a sacrifice in the first place? What for? Okay, it's a good question. Maybe I'll answer that and we'll end on that. See, in order to understand what the nature of sacrifice is, we have to look at the first instance of sacrifice. And does anybody know when the first sacrifice took place?
It was back with Cain and Abel, wasn't it?
Even before that. The first sacrifice, Maimonides brings down, that as soon as Adam was created, he offered a sacrifice right there at that spot. Okay? All right, Chaim, good. So, what was the concept then? And that now marked indelibly on all future sacrifices what the nature of sacrifice is, right? Because the inceptional activity always marks all the future ones, right? So whenever you have an event and there's an inception, so for example, a person builds a wall. So the first wall is built primarily for either to make an enclosure or to keep out an enemy, whatever it is. But now that is the first wall, so that is the definition of what wall is. Or you can also look at door. The first door was created to give entrance into a structure and to give the ability for exiting as well. That defines the very nature of door for all times. Whenever somebody makes a door afterwards, it is precisely modeling it after that primary function. It doesn't have to be the exact shape or the substance, but the function. So also with sacrifice or anything. Adam made the sacrifice as soon as he was created. Why? Because as soon as he was created, he recognized he was a creation. As Ibn Ezra says, one of the greatest commentaries on the Torah, he says that Adam the first was a great wise intellect. So he recognized the fundamental here. As soon as he was created, he realized that a moment ago he did not exist, and that his creation was due to God. And he recognized the reason why he was created, and why he was given intelligence, and that there should be this thing called a human that can perceive the Creator and enjoy to such a height of enjoyment a pursuit of wisdom. So he realized also that his existence is really not necessary. It was purely an act of kindness that God did. God had no need for man. God created man purely as an act of kindness. So Adam wanted to demonstrate a number of ideas. One, he recognized that that his existence was really not necessary. So, but he saw that God wanted man to exist, so he killed an animal, which is the closest thing to what he is, and he did it, of course, in a painless way, with a very, very sharp razor edge, so there's no pain to the animal. And animals are something which God said, you can use the entire earth for your own use. So God thereby gave man the right to kill animals. But Adam now wanted to demonstrate that I really should not be in existence. So he took a life to demonstrate that. But he also did it in God's name, meaning as a thanks, a great thanks for, look what you did. I did not exist, and now you created me, and I have such a great life ahead of me because of this. Because he had full knowledge. He wasn't an infantile mind. He had human intelligence, adult intelligence at that point. So that's why he brought sacrifice, to demonstrate our real nature as humans is not to exist, but it's merely a kindness from God, so we sacrifice. So that means all future sacrifices now mirror that. And that's why all the sacrifices Abraham had, and Isaac, and Jacob, and King David, and Solomon were at that very location where Adam was created, because they wanted to mirror the concept that Adam saw so clearly, that our existence is really not necessary, and we have thanks to God. So we show that our existence is not necessary by removing an existence, taking an animal's life. And then we also at the same time recognize that we're doing this in God's name, that it's because God created us. So that's the concept of sacrifice, is to know our place and to recognize that there is a subjugated relationship between man and God. Okay? So that's a primary idea in sacrifice.
Rabbi, can I raise a problem with that, or something that bothers me?
Sure.
I assume that's somewhere in the Talmud, that there's not that's not directly in the text, that he sacrificed as soon as he...
That's something which Maimonides brings down.
Okay. So, it would seem like if you were just created, and you recognized gratefulness to the Creator for the fact that you were created and you didn't have to be, to turn around and destroy something that the Creator also created seems like the backwards thing to do.
Yeah, but I told you that God told Adam, take the world and subdue it and use it for your own good. Animals, everything on earth is really for you. So he gave him the right to kill.
Oh, okay.
He was perfectly justified in killing the animal.
Okay, I see.
Okay, and Deanne, I don't know what you mean that God sacrificed for Adam. Do you want to read it? Because it says that God covered Adam with the skins. Right. Well, not with the skins of the animals that had to be sacrificed. He gave him animal skins to cover himself with, because Adam only covered himself with the leaves. But God did another act of kindness. Okay. Right, but that wasn't sacrifice. When God gave animal skins to Adam, it doesn't mean that he sacrificed. He means he sacrificed a life. Yes, that's true. You have that right. And the rabbis even say that although animals were not allowed to be killed for eating back then, but if Adam came across a dead animal, then he would be able to eat it. So it was only the act of killing the animal until the times of Noah. So only that he couldn't do the act of killing for that. But it doesn't mean he couldn't sacrifice to God. He was allowed to kill the animals to sacrifice to God. That was a perfection. So we can't look at animals and have pity. I mean, again, animals are dumb. They have no intelligence. So when we project on them, because they have eyes and a nose and they look like they're smiling, this is something which a person has to recognize is not a truth. And he can't have pity on something which God says, you know, don't show pity, but actually use it in service to me. Okay. And in terms of what you're asking, Kuzari, that did God actually have to kill the animal to create the skins? Well, I think we should go in terms of natural law at that point. Not that just God magically created skins of animals without the animal itself. So it would appear that he killed animals, took the skins, and gave them to Adam and Eve. We shouldn't assume things that are out of the norm. So the only way to get skins would be to kill the animal. Because if we go by that thinking, then you open up the whole Pandora's box about God just put the dinosaur bones in the earth, but there were never such thing as dinosaurs. He put them in there to test man. There's a very foolish view out there. So again, if we see that there is carbon-14 dating tells us that there's an age to something, and if we see bones means that there was life. So if there were skins that God gave to Adam and Eve, that means they came from animals. Okay, that's a side point. Okay, any other questions on the topic we did today?
I think we're good here.
You good there? All right, let me see if I have any other points. I think the one primary lesson here is really to understand that a person follows the emotions, they can lead to the most horrific type of satisfaction. And especially, back then, they didn't have the societal rules and, the court system which told us what is morally acceptable or not, so they went to those extremes. Today, thank God we have certain moral codes, even outside of the Torah. Okay, but that's so far. Any emotion can really be taken to a real destructive extreme case. And Chaim, you're asking about a chok, a statute like the red heifer. Is there any room for our intelligence for those matters? Yes, I mean, Moses knew the laws of that. It says that King Solomon knew the reasons for all of the statutes, all of the chukim. Chok or statute is the singular, and chukim is the plural. So King Solomon knew the reasons for all of the statutes, which includes tefillin and tzitzis and kosher. So the one he didn't know was red heifer. That doesn't mean there's no ideas there. I mean, anything which God creates has to be based in profound reasoning. And so there has to be intelligence there. All right. Rabbi Chait once said that the Rashi in Deuteronomy that states if a person does a command and he doesn't know why he's doing it, so it's really useless. Doesn't mean that he's free from performing the command. It just means that it missed its target. So a person is wise to use his intelligence and understand, why do I have to keep this command? What is the perfection in this law? Because then when he keeps it, he's doing it out of a real attachment to truth. I'm doing this because it makes sense to my mind. And you're saying, Chaim, you're saying what? That the rabbi said the test for what is fervor, fanaticism, how to distinguish one that is proper to do something we don't understand, or it seems counter to understanding. What I was saying before about fanaticism is that if you disagree with somebody and their immediate about their religious practices, and their immediate response is defensiveness, that is typical of a person who's just following things out of an emotional thrust and not out of intelligence. So now you're asking how to distinguish when it is proper to do something we don't understand. Well, we know what we must do. If it's written in the Torah, or in the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, we must do it. It's not up to our understanding to do it or not. We have to perform all the laws. But what we should do is understand what we have to do and study them. So this way our daily activities are all addressed. We understand why we're doing them. Then the holidays and Sabbath, things that are less common, so save that for later study, because it's more important that what you're doing on a regular basis, you have a grasp. Okay? Is that clear, Chaim? Any other questions? So next week is the 21st, the 28th. All right, so we'll continue. I think what we may do next week, if you want to start looking around a bit, is the breastplate of the high priest and the inserted names of God that were put in there.
I'm sorry, Rabbi, the breastplate of Aaron, did you say?
Yes. What was that whole thing with the names of the Jews on it? And if you do some research on it, you'll see that the names of God were inserted in a pocket behind it. It was basically a folded in half and created like a pocket. And what was the whole? It's a very odd type of a thing that before they go to war, so the priest that was the one who was anointed for war, who spoke to the Jews before they went to war, so he would be wearing the same eight garments as the high priest. And they would inquire from him, which then he would then contemplate God's name, which was in this breastplate. And miraculously, meaning they would inquire, should we go to war or not? Or will we be successful? Or any specifics about the war? They would inquire. And then he would get a response. And Ramban says the way the response came was that the letters on the engraved letters on each one of the 12 stones, each 12 stones had the names of the 12 tribes, and it also had Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's name. And then there was one letter still left, which was the tests. So then it said tribes of Israel, and Hebrew tribes of Israel contains the letter tests. So then they had all 22 Hebrew letters, and then each letter would light up that would spell out the answer. Amazing type of a miracle. So I was looking into it because it talked about it this past week's Parsha. And I think maybe next week, hopefully, we'll have some answers. But you could take a look as to what this phenomena was. What was the need for this type of a means of sort of a prophetic type of a communication? And the high priest, and why it was in the breastplate, and the names of the Jews were on the breastplate. I mean, there's a lot of questions. So you can do some research on that. Let me just see. Chaim still has another question. I could ask further, but no time left for Shir. Let me just see. Cell phones, no. Gotta disagree with you there, Chaim. Okay. All right, so we'll do this for next week. And again, it takes place in yesterday's Parsha. It's also found in Tetzaveh, which is in Exodus. So look in Parsha Tetzaveh, where it's commanded to make the choshen, the breastplate, and the actual names of God that were referred to as Urim and Tumim, the Urim and the Tumim. Urim, as the rabbis say, it's also on Talmud Yoma, Y-O-M-A, 73b. So you can take a look at 73a into 73b, but I believe in 73b is where it really talks about a little bit of this, the breastplate, and get some background on it. And this is what we'll take up. It's called Urim and Tumim, because Urim means to enlighten, and Tumim means to make perfect. So it would enlighten the priest when he would contemplate, he would get the answer of the question, should they go to war or not. And as Nachmanides says, so it would enlighten him to the words, but then he'd have to reason for himself what the answer was, and then he would tell over to the people. And there were stories in history I think by David and other cases where they actually inquired and they got a response. So they actually, you know, invoked this method of getting an answer about going to war. Okay, Deanne, thank you for that. And, all right, so we'll try to take this up next week. We'll see. We may just have a lot of questions. Hopefully, though, we'll have some answers. And, okay.
All right, thanks.
All right, my pleasure, Doug. Cal.
Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll pick up next week with this topic, so you got a little research to do. And 11:15 sharp, we'll start, because I see some people came on late today. So if you come on late, unfortunately, you know, we want to start on time, so I might be reading some text that is necessary for you to appreciate what the class is about. So get here early, get 11. So this way, as soon as we start, everybody will join in. You'll have the sound going already, and you'll have all the facts. This way you can appreciate the class more. All right, so until then, everybody, a good week, and look forward to next week's class.
Great, Rabbi. You have a great week, too.
You
thanks.
Too. Me too.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.